Okay, well, welcome back in. So, today I'm going to be giving a talk called 10 Points for an Awakening Sangha. And I haven't found this a very easy talk to write, I have to say. But in a way, the reason why I wanted to give it is was following on from last year's talk. So I don't know if you remember, but last year at Sangha Day, I gave a talk about, in a way, evoking this vision for the centre of being and building a vibrant community, a vibrant Sangha here at the Buddhist Centre. And in a way, that was part of a vision that had emerged for me as new chair, in conversation with other members of the Sangha. So in a way, what I wanted to do today was follow up from that talk, in a way, to come back to this question of, okay, if we're going to be and build a vibrant Sangha, how do we do that? Why do we do that? And I suppose it's, in a way, I think Sangha is the vision for a centre, or is important, because in a way we live in a world where I think we deeply need community. It's a forever fragmenting world, and I think the need for community is getting stronger and stronger. But also because, in a way, Sangha is, it's not just a nice thing we do, coming together, being a group, looking after each other, being friends. Actually, Sangha is a means for transformation. It is a means for spiritual growth. And in a way, that's why, if I'm trying to evoke anything today, I'm trying to evoke Sangha as the path for transformation. So my first point in this talk then is that we need to have confidence that we are awakening. And I've been thinking about this talk quite a lot over the last few weeks, but this morning this song kept popping into my mind, and that's all about awakening. Well, it's not. It's actually about climate change. And it's by a woman called Melissa Etheridge, for any of you who know the song. But it's about the need to wake up. And it was just popping into my mind this morning. So I, you know, as one does, Googled it on YouTube and listened to it. And it really struck something in me. It was like, God, I can't play that talk because I'll just be crying. And that isn't a good way to start a talk. But I thought it was something about this talk that... Well, it evokes something. So I'll read you the kind of chorus, if you like. She says, I need to move. I need to wake up. I need to change. I need to shake up. I need to speak out. Something's got to break up. I've been asleep. And I need to wake up now. And... in a funny kind of way, the line that really strikes me in that is this line, I need to speak out. I need to speak out. And I suppose that's, in a way, when I hear that line and I think, oh, here I am giving a talk at the Buddhist Centre, this line, I need to speak out, is something of... I think that evokes for me a bit of a personal myth. Yes, so when I was given my name Singamati by Parami 7 and a bit years ago when I was ordained, she very much evoked, this quality that I had of trying to speak the truth. Even though I don't find that necessarily very easy, standing up in front of people or in groups saying what I really think, it's something I'm passionate about. And it probably is, I would say, the myth of my life. This myth of speaking out over and over, however difficult or not difficult I find that. Yeah. So this need to speak out really resonates for me in this song. But yeah, this need to wake up. Yeah, that we can have confidence that we are awakening. So I think that's the first thing I wanted to evoke, really, this morning, is that we are all awakening. We wouldn't be here if we weren't. So the Buddha, of course, evokes awakening in its at its highest form, the perfection of wisdom and compassion. And as far as I know, we haven't got any Buddhas in this room, but we have got a room full of people that are awakening. Yeah, and these, we all have moments in our lives where we touch that awakening, where something happens, where a door opens in our minds, in our hearts, and we can awaken in moments. Yeah, so I was thinking, for me, in a way, that's why I'm here. So when I was, some of you will know this story, of course, but when I was 21, I was traveling on my own, backpacking around India. And I kept bumping into people that were going on retreats, and I thought, well, why not? I was a bit kind of bored of moving from place to place. So I decided that I'd go on retreat. And yeah, that was partly because it was a thing to do, as one does. But it was also that I was not in a very easy place in myself at that point in my life. I was scared for my future. And I was scared for how I would manage my future. I'd had quite a difficult few years at university, just quite a lot of suffering trying to get it right, but also, you know, some quite serious health concerns and not really knowing how that was going to pan out. So I wasn't in an easy space. And I thought, well, maybe this retreat will teach me something that will help me. So I went on this retreat, and during the retreat, I heard for the first time the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that our suffering is, in a way, caused by our wanting things to be different. But more importantly at that time, that there was a way to end suffering. Yeah. And I suppose actually being on retreat at that point in my life, being in silence for 10 days, doing about 10 hours of meditation a day, wasn't the best introduction. I wouldn't recommend it, really. But it was hard. It was really, really hard having to sit with myself. And I saw how strong my need to get it right was, how strong my need to be the best was, how strong my need to prove myself was. Because underneath all those needs to get it right, to prove myself, there was a lot of, there was a real lack of self-metta, there was a real lack of real confidence. And I saw so clearly that all those things caused me suffering. But more importantly, they caused suffering for the people around me, because I was always wanting things from those people to try and fill that gap in myself. And when I heard that teaching, actually I was more moved at that point to, yes, to be free of suffering for myself, but to not inflict that on the world, to not inflict that on the people around me. I didn't want to spend my life doing that, okay? And that's what brought me to a Buddhist centre, and that's what's kept me here all these years, is this knowing that deepening awareness and deepening kindness allows me to be of benefit to the world. Otherwise, I'm just grasping at it and causing suffering for myself and others. And it was interesting, just a couple of weeks ago, I had a very strong reminder of that very first insight, if you like, small eye into the Dharma. So I'd been ill, as some of you know, and I'd been at home a lot on my own, and I was feeling a bit frustrated about being on my own. And Dharmashala, my partner, was about to go away for the weekend on retreat, and I wanted him to go on retreat, because going on retreat is a good thing, and it's a good thing for him to go on retreat. But I didn't want him to go on retreat, because I wanted him to stay at home and make me happy. And I got myself into a bit of a pickle. And I think these days that pickle's a bit more refined, so thankfully I don't think too much of it went his way. But I got myself into a real pickle, actually. I was in a bit of a hole. I felt a bit miserable. And actually, thankfully, within a few hours, I could just see what I was doing. I was digging myself into this hole, this view that I needed him to be there to make me happy, which clearly wasn't true, actually. And I knew I'd be fine as soon as he'd gone. And there were plenty of friends that I could see the weekend. I had a really busy weekend, as it goes. But the point was, it's like you get yourself into this pickle, that I need that thing to be happy. And in that pickle, one creates a lot of suffering for yourself. I dig myself into this hole where I need something else to be happy. And when I'm living in that hole, I have to live from that place where I need that thing to be happy. And that's not a very nice place to live. So from, you know, for those of you who are familiar with the Tibetan Wheel of Life, it's very much I go into a kind of hungry ghost realm, yeah? And once I've built that narrative, I've built that view, it's hard to get out of it. But what, you know, in this case, it was like I saw, oh, you're building yourself a hole and you can get out. And actually all I needed to do was see that and I could get out. It's got a lot quicker, that process, over a decade and a half. So I guess we're all having those moments all of the time, yeah? We're all building a momentum of awakening from our own mental states, awakening from those realms that we're creating in ourselves, whether they're hell realms, whether they're hungry ghost realms, whether they're God realms, actually. You spend a lot of time just eating good food and watching nice movies, yeah? Whatever realms that you tend to inhabit when you're not really aware of yourself. And as soon as we bring awareness, we can wake up. We can wake up to the moment. And it was interesting, that morning meditating, I had this really strong voice in my mind, which was, the Dharma is the only balm to suffering. The Dharma is the only balm to suffering. Because actually all those other things, you know, people, places, nice holidays, good food, the perfect job, the perfect house, the most beautiful garden, they're all great and they do enrich my life to a great extent. But they are not the balm to suffering. The balm to suffering is awakening. And we awaken through awareness. So in a way, as a Sangha, we need to have confidence that we are awakening. Yeah, that we're having those moments in our lives where we do wake up, where we have choice. And that those moments will add up to more and more insight. So we need to keep looking up. So this is point number two. So we need to look up. So the Buddha is there as a symbol. He's there as a symbol, as a teacher, as a guide. And his life story, his story, and what he evokes for us is a reminder, a constant reminder of what it is that we're moving towards. Yeah. So we need to keep looking up to remember that there is this thing that we're moving towards, whatever that is for you. So maybe you look at the Buddha and you see a deep stillness, a deep peace, and you think, yes, that's it, that's what I'm moving towards. And maybe you don't relate so much to the historical Buddha. Maybe it's more this image of green Tara here on the shrine. And you relate more to a fearless compassion, a want to go out and help the world. But all these things are symbols, yeah? And we need to keep looking up to these symbols that help us remember in a way where we're going. And Subhuti recently has given a very good talk where he's been evoking the importance of reverence. And I found this really quite interesting talk, but also quite challenging. I guess for me, the being reverential, being devotional, having faith, isn't something I've necessarily found very easy. And I don't know if that's cultural or whether that's me, but I think it's interesting. It's an interesting area. I think reverence is really important. And I think for me there's something about, a need to really reflect on what it is that blocks my capacity to have reverence. And that's, you know, in a way that's it's a question for all of you, but it's definitely a question that I'm sitting with for myself at the moment. How can I develop a deeper reverence for the Buddhas? And I know that I can have a deep connection with the Buddha. There have been times in my life, certain conditions, say my ordination retreat or when I'm on retreat generally, where the Buddhas feel very alive to me, and I feel a very heartfelt connection with a sense of being a disciple of the Buddha. But then in my day-to-day life, that can kind of feel quite remote. And what is that about? So it's just, you know, in a way, it's reflecting on what helps us have that reverential attitude. There's this great quote by Vasubandhu, which Sankaracharya draws out in the Bodhisattva Ideal series. Vasubandhu says, "I think of Shakyamuni and other enlightened beings, and I reflect. As they were, so I can become. They started off as human beings, and so do I. They started off with weaknesses and imperfections, and so do I. They started off with all sorts of limitations, and so do I. But then look what they achieved. They transcended their limitations. They became Buddhas. They were human. I am human. What they achieved, I too can achieve, if only I make the effort." So we need to keep looking up to these symbols of the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, that help guide us in a way to what it is that we are becoming. But as I say, yeah, sometimes the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas can feel remote. And that's when we need friendship. Okay, so friendship is the third point on our path today. Sankaracharya said, "Sometimes you may not need a highly advanced Bodhisattva to help you. All you need is an ordinary human being who is a little more spiritually developed than you are, or even just a little bit more sensible." So yes, spiritual friendship. So this is where we start getting into the real heart, if you like, of the Sangha as a means for profound spiritual transformation. So I think for me, friendships within the Sangha have been a real vehicle for transformation. They offer a real vehicle for transformation. So for me, that's been things like the story that I was telling you at the beginning about trying to fill the gap in me through others. So friendship's been a great example over the years where I've learnt that I can't look to others to fill my own gap, to fill my own lack of self-metta or fulfilment, that has to come from myself. And that's come through these practices of self-metta, but it's also come from, learning to let people be who people are. I've had this real sense of learning to let friendships take their own shape. So not kind of neurotically trying to get what I want out of people to be my friend, to make me feel better. But just let a friendship be what a friendship is, and let that person be who that person is. And let the friendship, the connection between us, be the shape that connection that needs to be. Not try and force it in any particular direction. And that, for me, has been a huge lesson. As I was evoking earlier, I think the Hungry Ghost realm is very much a realm that I've had to find my way out of. I've had a lot of feedback over the years this sense of people feeling like I'm wanting something from them. And I think I've really had to learn how to not do that. And I've had feedback in more recent years that I don't do that, so that's also a good thing. But I think friendships also really taught me to see someone from their own side. So part of not making you my shape is learning to see what shape you are. So I had a very strong experience of meditating, and actually it was in the Metta Bhavana, and I was reflecting on a good friend who had somehow found their way into the difficult person stage. You know how that happens sometimes? Yeah. So in this meditation, somehow this image emerged. So it was me here, and this difficult person was like at the other end of the room here. And then there's all of you, and you're like the furniture in between me and the difficult person. And the furniture was like all the views, all the ouches, all the things that I didn't like that were going on between me and this person, this friend, that had become a bit, I was finding a bit difficult. And in this meditation, it was as if I managed to negotiate, weave my way through all of that furniture, all of that stuff that was in the way, and actually get to the other side, to actually meet the person at the other end and see them for themselves, see why they were behaving the way they were, without my agenda getting in the way, without my views, without my wants or not wants in the way. And it was quite profound, actually, just really meeting someone and going, oh, of course they would do it like that. I might not like the fact they do it like that, but of course they would do it like that. So we learn Sangha gives us this opportunity to transform ourselves, because it gives us the opportunity to really meet people on their side. Of course, it also gives us the opportunity to let ourselves be seen more fully by others, instead of hiding or trying to hide our vulnerabilities, our anger, our views about ourselves, the things that we think people won't like or are unacceptable to others, that we hide away. Yeah. Well, for myself anyway, hiding them away through fear that if you really saw who I was, then you wouldn't like me. So I try to put, it's like putting on that mask, yeah, putting on a mask of who I am. So Sangha gives us that opportunity to transform by letting ourselves be seen, yeah, in our study groups, when we meet up with people, when we're just bumping into each other at Sangha night or on a Tuesday, and someone says, how are you? And you think, ah, I could just say, yeah, fine, thanks. And maybe sometimes that's all right. And maybe you could also take the risk to say, actually, I've had a hard day, or I'm struggling with this, or I'm not feeling very well today. Or whatever it is that's going on for you, yeah? So we learn to be a bit more authentic about who we are. Sangha, of course, is a practice because it's a space where we're encouraged, and we encourage, hopefully. Yeah. So I remember I'd been on my first retreat at Tiruvannamalai, so for my first retreat when I was training for ordination. And there was a woman there, Vajradarshini, who has become a very good friend in my life. And she was leading the group on my retreat. And on that retreat, I was definitely having this whole like, oh, who am I? I'm not good enough, and I don't understand, and I haven't got anything to offer. I was definitely in that kind of space in myself. A lot of lack of self-metta was very strong at that stage or that point. And after the retreat, Vajradarshini sent me this email. She said, oh, let's keep in touch. And she sent me this email, and it was just two lines. In the subject line, it said, "You're so big," and then in the text of the email, it said, "I can see you all the way from Norfolk." And it was just like, it was just such a little thing. Like that must have taken her 30 seconds to have sent that, and it had such an impact on me because at that point in my life, I could not see my own potential. Yeah, I could not see. I had too much baggage in the way, yeah? I had too much baggage in the way. I couldn't see my potential. And that's what the greatest gift, in a way, that we've got for each other. Because we can see the potential more easily sometimes in others than we can in ourselves. And if we can say, I see that potential in you, just keep coming. Just go on that retreat. You can do it. You've got the capacity to give. You know, I remember I was in, when I just started to work here at the centre, and I was a bit worried about something. And Kalyana Prabhu, who was one of the trustees at that point, I was saying to her, I'm feeling a bit worried about how I'm going to deal with this. And she just said to me, Singamati, you've got a really deep capacity for metta. You'll be fine. Just bring your metta to it. You'll be fine. And she was right. That all I needed to do was bring metta. And something happened. Something else emerged. So, friendship is a real gift to us on our path of transformation. Generosity. So here I really want to make the point that we can all give, and that giving, again, is a very transformational practice. So for those of you that were here on Sankana on Thursday, you were treated to the lovely Sadnandi giving a very inspiring talk. For those of you who missed it, it has been videoed. It will go on YouTube in a few weeks. But she gave us this image in her talk, which I really, really loved. So it's an image of one of those old-fashioned slot machines that used to get an amusement arcade. You know when you put the penny in and the penny drops and that penny going in knocks off other pennies that knocks off other pennies. And sometimes when you put the penny in the top, hundreds of pennies fall out the bottom, yeah? Which is why we do it, yeah? So she this had been a really key image for Sadnandi at some point early on in her spiritual life, where she just had this really strong sense of herself as the penny. And, as a penny, you put yourself into the slot machine of the Sangha. And when you drop in, it shifts everyone else along. But you also don't really know what the effect's going to be. And I thought it was such a great image for the Sangha, because it's like we can all contribute. And I thought, well, some of us might not be pennies. We might be pound coins or £2 coins or old pound coins or 50p's or 20p's or whatever, really. We're all different shapes and sizes, I guess. But whatever shape or size we are, we all have something to contribute. We can all contribute. We do all contribute. The fact you're all here is a contribution. Yeah, so we can all contribute. And when we contribute, we contribute not really knowing what effect we'll have, but knowing that our contribution helps everybody move on a little bit. Yeah? It's more than us. And yet, we are empowered to contribute. That's why it's a great image. Because we're empowered to contribute, but our contribution affects everybody. Yeah. And giving really is a transformational practice. I'm just slightly like doing a time check and thinking how I'm doing. So yeah, giving really is a transformational practice. And in a sense, I think it is the practice that has most moulded me. So when I was 26, I moved to Taraloka Retreat Centre. Plan was to go for a year. I managed to stay for 7. The plans are funny things, aren't they? When I'd been there a couple of years, when I moved, I did all the bookings on the retreat bookings on the front desk. And I was in a small team of, there are just 3 of us running the practicalities of the retreat centre, which isn't enough, in case you're wondering. So we were a bit short-staffed. And then all of a sudden, for 2 very different reasons, the 2 people, and they weren't personal, I hope, the 2 people I was working with decided to leave at the same time. That was good fun. So I thought, okay, what's going to happen next? And we did manage to recruit a new team, and that was fantastic, and that's another whole story. But there was going to be this gap of about at least 6 months where I didn't have a team. And I would just be trying to manage running the retreat centre, which I hadn't really done before, with volunteers, whoever I could get, and have some good volunteers. But can you see, that was like a total stretch. I'd been there a year and a half. I had no vision to manage the running of a retreat centre. And yet, all of a sudden, that's what I was doing. And it was a stretch. And it was so that was the kind of my 3 years running up to getting ordained. And when I got my invitation to be ordained, and the community there were rejoicing in my merits, sending me off to Akash Bhavana. One of the women there, she said to me, she said to Lindsay, as I was then, she said, "You're a very ambitious woman. You've got a lot of energy and ambition that you want to put into something." She said, and that was always going to be tricky when you're trying to get ordained, because you end up putting your ambition into this thing called getting ordained. And she said, the best thing that happened to you was the fact that you had this other project that needed all your ambition and all your energy, and that was called running the retreat centre. And that's what helped you get ordained. And it was something about that. It was like our kind of ordinary ambition or energy can be really put to use and help us to grow spiritually. So I think for me, that stretch, that having to go beyond what I thought I was capable of, really, it just brought so much growth. It brought so much growth. So giving more than we think we can sometimes really can help transform us. And even if our motives are mixed, even if we think, oh, but maybe I'm doing that just because I want people to think I'm a good person in the Sangha. In a way, all of those motives get purified as we do it. And even if that is the main motive, you won't keep it up for long under that motive. So just do it anyway and see what happens. So this takes us in a way to point number 5. Sangha is the practice. So can you see, have I evoked that well enough, that Sangha is the practice, yeah? That Sangha's not something we add on. It's not a friendly bunch of people that we practice alongside. Sangha is the practice. Yeah, it is the practice in which we grow and we transform. So the heart of Buddhism is this, is the deepening of wisdom. And that deepening of wisdom, in a way, is going beyond our self-concern, going beyond our deluded sense of ourselves as fixed, as this concrete sense of me and mine. And Sangha gives us this direct opportunity to be something, part of something bigger, yeah, to serve something bigger. So it's directly helping us to grow. It is a practice. Okay, so Sangha is a practice. It is the practice. And it is a practice that's going to help us transform and awaken all the way to enlightenment. So what do we do? So the second half of the list is much more about practicing amidst the Sangha on that basis. So I wanted to talk a little bit about ethics. So the Sangha is a jewel. Yeah. In Buddhism, we talk about the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Sangha is a jewel, and jewels are precious. They're precious, and we need to take care of them. And we take care of the Sangha jewel by acting ethically. Okay. So when we do something unethical, unskillful in the Sangha, it has an effect, not only on ourselves, and the person concerned, if it was a two-person thing, but it has an effect on everybody. And so we, being part of a Sangha, it raises the game when it comes to practicing ethics. So I'm going to talk briefly about ethics in two areas. So first is speech. So again, when I was at Taraloka, there was one person, particularly in the community, always seems to be one person, doesn't there, that you're a bit critical of, quantum of negativity, going in that direction. Probably nothing to do with them, it's just I've got this quantum of negativity and it's happened to be latching onto person X. So this person X, I felt a bit critical of in the community. And I knew when I felt critical of them, if I went to talk to person A, who also found them a bit difficult, we'd get into a right good one. We could, oh yeah, they're really annoying in that. Oh yeah, wasn't that so annoying? And we could go off on a whole one. They'd really collude with me. It was quite entertaining sometimes. And sometimes maybe that is what I needed. And I also knew that if I went to person B, that they, even though they, I could tell, found them a bit irritating in the same way sometimes, they wouldn't collude with me. They would just really stick their ground and they would listen and they would reflect me back. They wouldn't indulge me. They wouldn't indulge me. And that was an interesting learning. Because who did I go to, person A or person B? Because I knew where that would go for me and I knew what the consequences of that were. You know, if me and person A had had a good rant about them and then we're seeing them at dinner, what's the effect on everyone? Even if no one else knows we've had that conversation, me and them know we've had that conversation. And it feeds something, doesn't it? It feeds this narrative about this person. It feeds the view that I'm right, that they are irritating, rather than that's just me and my irritation. Yeah. So it was a strong learning, really. And I think it has an effect. It had an effect on me. It had an effect on the person I found difficult. It had an effect on the whole community. And so when we feel critical of something at the centre, whether that's a person or an event or how something's done, what do we do with that? Because it's not always skillful just to sit on it, is it? Because it normally comes out sideways anyway. But how do we communicate about that in a way that's going to help in a positive way? Because not talking about, you know, people... You can't let criticisms just fester. You do need to talk about them sometimes. But how do we do that in a way that helps rather than just feeds a kind of critical, oh, that's a bit crap, isn't it, kind of energy? And I'm saying that to myself as much as anyone else in this room. Okay. Sex. Got to say something about sex. So, I've been involved in this community since I was 21. So... most of my sexual relations have been with members of the Sangha. And I was really struck this one time. It was while I was living at Taraloka, and my relationship with my then partner had been... we'd been together for about 3 years. And it was obvious that although we really loved and respected each other on one level, it wasn't going to work out as a relationship long term. So we were going to meet to kind of end it, and that was kind of fairly mutual, but it was still difficult. And I was just preparing to go off to meet with this person, and someone in my community said to me, she said, remember, you've got to do this well. You're going to be in the order together. And there was something about that. It was just like, oh yeah, I've got to do this well. And we did do it well, and they're now a very good friend. But what would the consequences have been if I hadn't have done that well? Yeah, for me, for them, and for the Sangha. So, you know, there's good reasons why, as Buddhists, we want to be in relationships with other Buddhists sometimes. But we have to be careful when we're in relationships with other people in the Sangha, because it affects not only us and that person, it affects the whole Sangha. Work on your mind. I'm always struck when I hear the story of the three Aniruddhas, which I guess you all know. These three Aniruddhas meet the Buddha, and the Buddha says, how do you live in harmony together? And they say, well, it's because we live together with bodily, verbal and mental acts of loving kindness. And I'm always struck by this story because I think, yeah, not too bad on the bodily acts of loving kindness, doing all right on that. Verbal, bit more shaky ground occasionally, but generally 80% doing fine. Mental, well, that's my world, you don't need to know about that. It's a challenge, isn't it? It's not too bad, honestly. But it's a challenge. The mental acts of loving kindness, what we do with our minds. So transforming our minds, in a way, is the highest form of ethics, in terms of ethics. But it's also the core idea of Buddhism, isn't it? You know, the Dhammapada starts with this: experiences are led by mind, produced by mind, preceded by mind. What we do with our mind creates our world, yeah? So if you're creating mind states where you're living in a view, say, to go back to the beginning, where if I'm living in a world where I'm unlovable, or I'm living in a world where I'm hating people, then that's a mind I'm creating. If I'm creating a hungry ghost realm in my mind of wanting something from others, that's the world that I then end up living in, okay? So our mind, our mental states create the world that we live in. And that's true of the world as well. So that's true of me personally. But if we look at the world, we look at world politics, we see that all the time, that our views create the world. So often when we first come to the Buddhist Center, one of the first teachings we'll learn is mindfulness, for this very reason, really. Mindfulness of body, feelings, emotions, thoughts, mental states. And that's because this awareness is revolutionary. Yeah, to quote Sankaracharya, awareness is revolutionary. Because it's that gap when we're aware of something, we have a choice. Yeah, we have the choice of what we do with it. And traditionally, we talk about that as dwelling in the gap, don't we, of feeling and craving. So knowing our feelings, whether they're painful or pleasant, and having a gap between what's happening, that feeling, and the craving and aversion, yeah? So traditionally we talk about it in that way. I've also recently been really struck by the image of unhooking, which I haven't got the exact reference from. Vasanthu was talking about a lot on retreat last year, but I think it comes from a seminar with him somewhere. So unhooking. So we unhook from our thoughts, our minds, our mental states. I really like this because it's an image. And the gap is an image, but it's a different kind of image. So recently I was on solitary retreat and I was processing quite a difficult interaction that I had with someone that I'm very close to about a year ago. And a year on, I'm still processing that. And in that processing, I'd be sitting meditating or drinking a cup of tea, and suddenly in my mind, I'd find myself in a huge argument with this person or confrontation. I'd be like, where the hell's that come from? Yeah. And I was seeing the person after the solitary, so it was quite like I was a bit anxious about that. So that was like, it was quite alive in that space. But I'd find myself in these mental scenarios. And I would find myself down the road, you know, just thinking about, you know. And what would happen in my body then is I'd be stirring up anger, I'd be stirring up anxiety, I'd be stirring up grief, I'd be re-stirring up the hurt from a year ago. It enlivens all of that. So the mind creates a scenario, and then the emotions are in there. What came first? I don't know, chicken or egg, maybe. And this image of unhooking became incredibly potent to me because it was like I could just unhook. I'd go, oh yeah, that's that scenario arising. That's that thing that's painful. And I could come into the body and attend to the grief, attend to the fear, attend to the anxiety. So one didn't need to alienate oneself from one's thoughts, but one had a choice about what one did with them. Yeah. So this image of unhooking. And I think this is our central practice of working on the mind. And I think it has, you know, it has a really positive effect when we can do that in the Sangha, when we can work on our minds, a bit like for the reasons I was just mentioning around ethics or working on the mind. So in a way, there's a reflection there of what helps you to work on your mind and what are the effects of not working on your mind for yourself, your life, and for others. Others at home, others in the Sangha. Forgiveness. So as you can see, forgiveness was also a bit of a theme on this solitary retreat. So that happens in life, doesn't it? We're wounded, we're hurt. Now, I know there may be some of you in this room who've undergone significant trauma in your life, and forgiveness is a process, so please don't feel that I'm saying you need to have that all tied up and sorted now. Yeah, but I suppose there are some wounds that we carry that actually we could let go of, and if we don't, that has negative consequences for us and for each other. So earlier this year, I was reflecting a bit. Some of those wounds got a bit touched for me. So I was reflecting on some kind of painful conversations that I've had with friends in the order over the last decade. Not very many, but there's one or two conversations that kind of stick in my heart a bit, where someone's been quite challenging to me or not very supportive of a decision that I'm going to make. And I found that quite painful, okay? And even at the time when that happened, you know, I wrote to the person, I said, look, I don't think it's okay. This wasn't okay, actually, that you said that. And, yeah, we made amends, at least to some extent. But that still sticks in my heart. And how can I forgive more deeply? How can I let go of that? Because if I don't, it has an effect. It has an effect on the whole Sangha. If I'm carrying around those wounds from that person, because they once said they didn't like X, I carry a view that they always don't like X. Yeah? And actually, that's not very healthy. They might have apologised for X. Yeah? So it is important, I think, when we're hurt by each other to try our best to let go of that. And even if that's us doing our own work with ourselves. And when we forgive, I really love this quote, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and realise that that prisoner was you. Because when we hold hurt, we mainly hurt ourselves. We hold on because maybe we don't want to we feel that letting go would let that person off the hook or would excuse the hurt. We don't want to be open to being hurt again. But actually, forgiveness is a gift for yourselves and for others. Last two points, appreciation. So appreciation and gratitude. So this, in a way, learning to appreciate and be grateful, it's not actually something that comes very naturally to us. We're much more negatively hardwired. We notice what is painful. We notice what went wrong more quickly than we'll notice or remember what went well, yeah? And that's part of how our brains work, yeah? And if you're really interested in that, I would definitely recommend this TED Talk by Rick Hansen called Hardwiring Happiness, which is a total gem. Yeah, so he's really talking about that. He's really talking about the neuropsychology behind letting in the good, dwelling on appreciation and gratitude. And that's something here in the Trimana Buddhist community we've always held quite close, the importance of rejoicing in merits, yeah? So we have that section, don't we, in our sevenfold puja, but we also have it as a ritual as part of our community to rejoice in people for their good work. So I was thinking about this occasion where I was asked to rejoice in someone's merit. So I was asked, my friend Vajradarshini, again, she was joining the chairs meeting and I was there as Young Buddhist Coordinator. And I was the person who knew her best. And they said, would you introduce her? And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to say? She's someone I was a bit awestruck by, in a way. So I was a bit like, oh my God, how will I do that well? And will I do it well enough? And we hadn't seen each other very much in recent times. So I was a bit like, oh, maybe I'm a bit out of date and I don't know quite what to say. But anyway, I was apparently the best person to do it. So I said, all right, I'll have a go. So I had a go. I think I did okay. And actually, at the end of it, she came up to me and she thanked me for introducing her. And it had a real effect on our relationship in that moment. So as I said, we hadn't seen each other for a few years. And she's someone I was a bit awestruck by. And when I rejoiced in her, it was like I saw her. To rejoice in her, I had to really reflect, what are her qualities? What is it about her I really love? Irrelevant of me, really, like, what are her qualities? And there was something about that that brought a real intimacy between us. It brought us closer in that moment. And we can be frightened. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is we can be frightened in rejoicing in each other's merits. Maybe we'll get it wrong. Maybe we'll rejoice in the wrong quality, or maybe they won't like it. Maybe it won't be good enough. That's what we can get into for ourselves. But actually, it has a huge effect. It brings us closer, and it helps people to be encouraged and to feel seen. It's a gift. It's a gift you all have to give. So last point, take your practice seriously. Set up conditions that will help you go deeper. So I was remembering this quote that Dharmashalan started this talk at a Young Buddhist retreat probably 8 years ago, something like that. And he said, if you want to have deep conversations, then you've got to be deep. And that's something he'd realised for himself just a few minutes before giving the talk. And it was a challenge in it that I quite enjoyed. It was a bit like, well, we all aspire to depth. But the truth is, if we want depth, we have to bring ourselves to that party. So what is it that helps us go deeper in ourselves? Is it through friendship? Is it through contributing, joining here at the centre? Is it through Dharma study? Is it through meditation? Is it through going on retreat? Is it something else? So what is it that really brings depth into your life? So when I started my work as a Young Buddhist Coordinator, I did a survey. So I surveyed about 300 young people online survey. And one of the questions in that survey was, what's helped you go deeper? And by far and away, the biggest thing that people felt that was helping them go deeper was going on retreat. And I suppose in some ways that's been my experience. It's those experiences of a kind of immersed time, whether it's a weekend or a week, with friends in the Sangha, with meditating more effectively and for longer, that really help us go deeper, to have insights. They kind of feed us, don't they? For me, a retreat feeds me a bit till the next time I go on retreat. You know, it's like this momentum. If I drop below 20 miles an hour, something's going wrong, and then I just go on retreat and it tops me back up to cruising speed, you know. So I think going on retreat is crucial. But again, everything we do in between time, you know, meditation, study, friendship, also helps us go deeper. So I've just started leading a year-long foundation study group with some of the women here. And I think, God, that's an opportunity for me to go deeper. I've got to help people understand the basics of Buddhism and meditation, and that's a challenge. Teaching is always a challenge to helping us go deeper. Explaining what we mean to each other always helps us go deeper. Yeah. So whether you're leading those contexts or whether you're just in those contexts, they are a real strong, potent opportunity to go deeper. So these are our 10 points for us as an awakening Sangha. And yeah, I hope they give you a flavour of the breadth of the potency in a way of Sangha. And that Sangha is a means to transform ourselves. Yeah, it's not just a nice bunch of people practicing the Dharma and meditating, coming together. We come together because it is this context that will help us transform more deeply. Okay?